This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing today. Show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and the signature sponsor is the office of East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor Sharon Weston Broom, who will be with us in a bit. And of course, her sponsorship has nothing to do with any conversations we have with her. And tomorrow, her major opponent, Ted James, is slated to be with us, and they will talk about St. George, among other matters. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with Quinn Hillier, the New Orleanian who's based in Mobile, writes a column regularly for The Advocate and Picayune. He worked for The Picayune as a correspondent before becoming a member at high levels of the staff of U.S. Representative Bob Livingston in 1987. And if you remember, Livingston ran a strong race for governor. He finished third in 1987. Quinn was fresh out of Georgetown when he was in that campaign. And when Livingston, many years later, as in 11 years later, was on the brink of becoming Speaker of the House, all the Louisiana delegation was behind him. And at that point, it was largely a Democratic delegation. The Democrats felt that Livingston, as a member of our state, would help Louisiana immensely in his position as Speaker. Well, last year, Steve Scalise was on the brink of becoming Speaker of the House, and he did not have, as reports indicate, full support from the delegation. Quinn Hillier wrote about that a few weeks ago in his column, and I know he's gotten some pushback because it was a searing column. In fact, Roy Fletcher said, I thought it Quinn was channeling the ghost of James Gill. But Quinn, you were particularly hard on Garrett Neil Graves, a congressman from the 6th District. And Garrett Graves says he did nothing to thwart Scalise's effort to become Speaker of the House. You feel differently. What's going on in reality on this?
Well, first of all, I was independently getting reports on this. I got some from Louisiana delegation, but I had witnesses that were not from Louisiana who were telling me that Garrett Graves was saying bad stuff about Scalise when Scalise was still up for the speakership. And I only stopped that reporting. I was, trying to get more sources and nail down more details, et cetera. I stopped that reporting when the Advocate / Picayune, Mark Ballard, their reporter up in D.C., did basically a definitive report, said he found 19 different people that were reporting various elements of the same thing that I was hearing. And so when he had 19 sources and reported it rather definitively, I said, okay, well, I don't need to go there anymore. And I dropped it. That was months ago. But the reports were that Garrett Graves was going out of his way to tell people that Scalise's health was worse than Scalise was indicating, or at least dicier than he was indicating, and to basically put him down in various other ways. And Graves was very close to the ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and even though Scalise had nothing to do with ousting him, they were known not to be particularly close. And I don't know what Garrett Graves was thinking. I don't know why he did it. But the reports were that that's what he was doing. And so I just sort of put that in the back of my mind until Garrett Graves did something else a couple of weeks ago that, again, seemed petty politically. And that's why, in order to show what I thought was a history of pettiness, I also brought up the Scalise stuff again.
Well, I have a feeling that you heard from Mr. Graves, and I've been down this road before. Probably what was said between the two of you was agreed that it would be a off-the-record conversation. But is it fair to say you heard from the congressman?
I would rather not even say whether I heard from the congressman. You can imagine that that his staff certainly acknowledged having read it, I've heard that they read it, but I don't want to go any farther than that.
Okay.
And I've got, and I do have to say this, you know, I picked two incidents where I thought Garrett Graves really did not do the right thing or say the right thing or behave the right way. I have to say that in rereading my own column, it came out a little too harsh, considering that, you know, that a congressman's career is a lot more than just two instances. And I still think exactly what I wrote about those two incidents, the Scalise thing, and then, you know, some of his stuff related to Ukraine. But people do need to look at his whole record, and you know, and maybe they will see some things that they like there as well.
Well, and at times
I'm trying to be fair.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about. And at times through the years, I have taken exception to votes by the congressman. I thought it was a terrible vote, and he did it again on Ukraine. But John Bel Edwards, of all people, said that Garrett Graves was the hardest working member of the Louisiana delegation, and he's very popular with some Democrats, including former Governor Edwards, and he got off to a rocky start with him. And I know Hiller Moore, the DA here in East Baton Rouge Parish, likes him a lot, and he is all dressed up, and some say no place to go. He's got $5 million in his bank account. And when all is said and done, it will probably be the case that Cleo Fields, even if he loses round one in court, will have a district of his liking, 54% black. And then there's Julia Letlow's district, which Graves could run in, a person in Louisiana. If you're a citizen of the state, you can run in any district you want. But the most likely scenario would be for him to run against Cleo Fields. And I know, based on conversations that have been told to me by multiple people, that Graves is confident that he's going to be okay. And you know what? He might be right, Quinn. I don't know that it's a given that Cleo Fields would win this race. I think he'll be a heavy favorite, but if Graves goes all out, it could be a horse race.
If Graves can make a horse race out of a 54% black district, then that would actually be a good thing, not because Graves is better than Fields or vice versa, but because I am sick of the automatic assumption that that race determines voting, and that you know, one race should vote for one party and the other race should vote for another party. I think it's always a good thing, or almost always a good thing, basically, when, you know, a white or a black Democrat might win in a conservative white district and a black Democrat in a conservative white district, and say a black Republican or a white Republican in a liberal black district. I think we've got to get past all the race stuff. So if he wants to make that a really good race, I would love to see it.
877-217-5757. And last week, Graves voted against the Ukraine package, as did Julia Letlow, by the way, and as did Clay Higgins. Now, Scalise voted for it. Mike Johnson obviously voted for it. And Troy Carter voted. So our delegation was split 3-3. The vote was 311 to 112 in the House. It was not close, but most of the Republicans were against it. Your thoughts?
Slight majority of Republicans were against it. And I am told that you know, there were a good 15 or 20 at least Republicans who behind the scenes said, well, you know, we're really for it, but we can't afford to take that vote politically, because they know it's the right thing to do. And Garrett Graves knows it's the right thing to do to support Ukraine, but he didn't do it. And that's more what my column was about, was the reasoning, the pure political partisanship that Garrett Graves was showing when he said, well, Joe Biden asked for the aid first for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan. And so if he asked for it first, Republicans should get something in return. And I said, well, wait a minute, but you've said that you support the concept of aid for Ukraine. We know you support aid for Israel. We know you support aid for Taiwan. So if it's the right thing to do, why should you be trading it off? You do the right thing. maybe you trade off something you don't want for something you do, but you don't hold hostage something that you do want for something else that you do want, especially when the thing, the first thing that you're trying to hold hostage involves an existential threat to the very survival of a nation, of an innocent nation that has been brutalized and that is fighting very well for itself and only needs ammunition. And to make that political trade-off when they're fighting for their very lives, I thought was despicable.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Quinn Hillier, and then we're slated to hear from Mayor President Sharon Weston Broome. And the eyes of the nation are on New York City today as Donald Trump goes back into a courthouse for second week of his trial. And there is unrest, to say the least, at Columbia University. We'll talk about it. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Quinn Hillier is with us for a few more moments, the conservative columnist and commentator. And in New York City today, the attention was likely to be dominated and still is to some extent by Donald Trump's continuation of his trial in Manhattan on proposed or supposed illegal hush money payments. But protesters began occupying a central campus building at Columbia University this morning, a day after school asked the protesters to voluntarily disperse from an encampment set up in support of Palestinians. Once inside, students chained and barricaded the doors. Hours later, the Public Safety Department at Columbia announced what amounts to a lockdown of the campus in Morningside Heights, with access restricted to essential service employees and students who live in residential halls on the campus. So, Quinn Hillyard, this war in Gaza is now being felt in America in a profound way, and it's reminiscent of 1968. I think this could potentially affect the presidency and the election, just as Hubert Humphrey was affected in 1968.
Well, maybe so. Look, Ben Sasse, the former U.S. Senator, Republican Senator from Nebraska, who is very well respected on both sides of the aisle, was not a Trumpie, left to become president of the University of Florida. When all this stuff started at these idiot Ivy League schools and West Coast schools that don't know how to handle things, he and his administration put out a statement that said, we respect the right to free speech, we even respect the right to protest, but there are also rules. And free speech and protest are not the same thing as trespassing, not the same thing as threatening, not the same thing as violence. And he said, here are the rules. And as long as you follow the rules, you can protest all you want, but if you don't follow the rules, you're going to be immediately suspended and possibly subject to arrest. And, you know, it pretty much worked. And then some of the students at Florida tried to test him, and bingo, they were immediately suspended, and they put out another statement that said, see, we told you so. That's how you handle things. You do not let it get out of hand. There are innocent students that have no dog in this fight, whose lives are being disrupted, who at the University of Southern California, they're having their graduation ceremony eliminated because these over-spoiled brats are trespassing and threatening and yelling hateful stuff and getting in the way of everybody else's rights. That cannot be countenanced. It cannot be accepted. You've got to crack down on them.
And not so far away, New York, to have so many people is a relatively small place. It's walking distance to the courthouse where Donald Trump will waltz in, and he's facing the music potentially from a jury in his hometown that quite possibly will not be as charitable as a jury would be, say, in Florida or Georgia or anywhere in the Southeastern Conference. But last week, and a listener asked about, this is asked me to ask you, and it's pertinent because Quinn, of course, is a journalist, this story that David Pecker, who was the star witness in week one, was catching and killing stories about Donald Trump and other people. In fact, he acknowledged he did it with Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mark Wahlberg, Tiger Woods, and he would get in exchange for that, he would get access to these people. But a listener asks, is this commonly done in journalism, or is this just David Pecker?
This is National Enquirer. This is tabloid journalism, which isn't journalism at all. But that is not what happens in mainstream journalism of any way, shape, or form. And it's despicable. It's unacceptable.
Well, the stories that were caught and killed involved $150,000 to Karen McDougal, a former Playboy playmate who alleges a year-long affair with Trump. Says she was in love with him, by the way. And Stormy Daniels, who does not acknowledge that she loved Donald Trump, but she got $130,000, the pride of Scotland Bill Magnet did, to stay quiet and then ultimately did not stay quiet about her alleged involvement with the former president when he was a private citizen. She is an adult film star, which adds a new layer of activity to this. But in the old days, Quinn, as you know, we can go down the list, Gary Hart, John Edwards, and think about what Bob Livingston was accused of doing and how it cost him the speakership, and compared to what Trump has been accused of doing, and he just rolls merrily along with about 40% of the electorate. How do you explain this?
Double standards. Conservatives, so-called conservatives, no longer living up to their own professed standards, especially religious conservatives, but also some changing mores nationwide, and also just the very nature of Trump. I mean, a lot of people just assume Trump in his private life is a horrible person, and they've written and they've said that doesn't matter to them. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons, there are a lot of different things, but it's so tawdry, and it should be unacceptable in a president to have somebody that is literally paying off porn actresses in order to hide what, you know, not even affairs, but just, you know, liaisons. And then lying about it. And then, I mean, this whole thing, we can do better than that, this, and we should.
Well, thank you, Quinn Hillier. Always good to talk with you. Let's keep it going.
Thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate it.
We're joined now by Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom, who has been busy as always, but particularly so the last few days, sifting through the Supreme Court decision. The Louisiana High Court voted 4-3, a one-vote margin, which presumably makes St. George the fifth largest city in Louisiana, 86,000 residents at least, which would put it right behind Lafayette, be New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Shreveport, Lafayette, St. George. There we are. 877-217-5757, your number. Mayor Broom, I know it was a disappointment for you, but I can't tell you how many people who were joyful about this thought you would no longer be the mayor of St. George, but you're the mayor of the whole parish, St. George, Central, Zachary, Baker, Baton Rouge. You're the mayor of every hamlet in Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge Parish. Your thoughts about where we are right now?
Well, first of all, Jim, you know, we have a consolidated form of government still. So I am the mayor president, the mayor of Baton Rouge, the president of the parish. So they will not get rid of me just like that. And let me just say this. My consistent message has been, since I have been mayor president, I've been looking out for every municipality, hamlet, everybody who's been a part of this parish, and I'll continue to do that. Yes, the Supreme Court's ruling was a disappointment. It's my understanding that the judicial system allows an ability to provide for a rehearing. In this case, I am no longer, of course, a plaintiff after the appellate court removed me, but I just want everybody to remember that our lawsuit was never a challenge to the legitimacy of the 2019 election. Rather, our suit was out of concern that the organizers had not provided a clear plan for how the city would provide basic services to its citizens without raising taxes. And I have to say, I still have this concern.
Well, it affects both entities. It affects the parish and it affects St. George. We always like the quote, win-win. Is this a lose-lose based on the early read?
Well, of course, you know, I'm the ultimate optimist, so I'm not going to say it's a lose-lose because I'm going to continue to work tirelessly to keep this city together in every aspect. But there will be a impact, I believe, on the citizens of the new city, potential city of St. George, as well as the residents of the remaining parts of our city and parish because of the budgetary decision.
All right, we do have to take a short break, but we will return and spend a few more minutes with Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sharon Weston Broom, the mayor president, seeking a third term in office. She's been mayor president for almost 8 years now of the state's largest parish, and she continues to be the mayor president for all the entities, including St. George. But there will be developments based on a Supreme Court decision last week. 4-3 was the vote, one vote to spare. 54% of the voters in 2019 chose to incorporate St. George, but there was a court battle after that. And this has come up before, Mayor, but wouldn't it have been better for the whole parish to vote, and why was that not done?
Absolutely. It would have been better for the whole parish to vote because this new city impacts everyone in the parish. Unfortunately, it was just the vote was just given to folks in that area to decide. But I have to tell you that there are a lot of issues that still have to be worked out. And at the end of the day, of course, I am going to follow the law and collaborate with any transition. But I found it interesting, Jim, and I'm sure you read this as well, that Chief Justice Weimer said that the decision in this case achieves a result masquerading as an opinion. And so, you know, I was there in the courtroom when we went to every level to try to unify and keep this city and parish together. And I will tell you that it's still, given the outcome of this case, there is still a lot of work and discussions that need to take place. And of course, it does speak to the fact that we need experienced leadership to navigate this season that we're in.
What are the next steps?
Well, the next step, of course, as I shared earlier, the plaintiff, the new plaintiff, and the attorneys have 14 days to ask for a rehearing. If the rehearing is granted, then that's another level of consideration that will have to take place in another period. But if the rehearing, of course, is not granted, there will be movement forward with the transition team. I will meet with the organizers to discuss what they want or would desire the city of Baton Rouge Parish to continue to serve them with. So there are a lot of details as we talk about the delivery of basic services, as we talk about maintenance of major drainage canals. These are all issues we will have to work out in the transition.
Okay, a listener asked, a lot of these entities in St. George, businesses were annexed out at their own request, and a listener asks a good question. I think the biggest tax producer would have been the Mall of Louisiana, but that was one of those that was annexed out, wasn't it?
That is correct. The Mall of Louisiana was annexed out, as well as several businesses in the area. So once again, Jim, that puts a big question mark to the citizens in that area. Will your taxes go up as a result of this new city? And I do believe that that is something that is going to that the citizens of the new city will have to certainly consider. I believe the verdict is still out on that, that there is a great potential for taxes being raised in that area.
Okay, we got about a minute left with the mayor, and in fairness, I know this gentleman to be a supporter of St. George, but I do ask you to be civil. Patrick and Enniswald, please be brief with Mayor Broome.
I'm not necessarily a supporter of St. George, but I did have a question about annexations. What about like Women's Hospital and Willow Ridge? Because they were annexed in 2021 after the vote. Do those now go back to City of St. George, or are those going to remain with City of Baton Rouge?
All right. Good question from Patrick. Mayor?
Patrick, it's my understanding, unless I'm told differently from legal counsel, is my understanding that their annexation still remains.
I don't know why it wouldn't. I don't think that vote has anything to do with whether an entity is annexed in or out. But it's going to be fascinating to follow, and thank you for taking time today. Always good to talk with you, Mayor Broome.
Same here, Jim. I look forward to coming back and talking a little bit more about this issue.
We will do it. Thank you. And as noted, the mayor is, her office is an underwriter for our show, but this is an office endeavor. It is not a campaign endeavor, but it is an election year, and tomorrow, Ted James, who is her announced opponent, also a Democrat, former state lawmaker, he was in the legislature when all this St. George stuff happened with Bodie White leading the charge, and he will be here to talk about that, and we look forward to hearing from you as always. But Tom Aswell is with us. He lives in Denham Springs, the intrepid journalist from Ruston who's done Louisiana Voice. Couldn't keep him down. He's still writing at age 80. 80 or 81 now?
80.
Coming
up on 81 pretty quick.
What's your birthday, Tom?
October 1.
October 1. Same as Jimmy Carter and same as Sharon Weston Broome, by the way.
Oh,
how about that?
Mayor Broome, I didn't know. Yeah. I knew Jimmy Carter was October 1.
Yeah, yeah. So Jimmy Carter will be 100. I think he's going to make it, too.
It looks like it. I think Buddy Romer's October 2nd.
He's October 4th, 1943.
Okay.
Born the same day as Rap Brown.
Well, he was born the same year I was, just 3 days later.
Really?
I was born in 43, yeah.
All right. Well, what's your take on this St. George stuff?
Well, I haven't been following that too much. I've been kind of concentrating.
You used to live in St. George. In fact, you're sitting in St. George right now.
I did live in St. George when I worked for the Baton Rouge State Times back in the 80s. I lived on South Potwin Street, and nice neighborhood. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but it now has a new name, and when I look at this meeting, it is apparent that, and I hate to go there, but I think it's necessary, all white people cheering, yelling, screaming, carrying on, they think it's a great thing, and the organizers, they were honest, they'd annexed Gardier out, and if Gardier had been in there, it would not have passed, and you got to give these people credit. They call it gerrymandering, but it's done everywhere now.
Yeah.
It's done everywhere. And they did play by the rules.
Yeah.
And they won. So, Tom Aswell, worse things have happened. I don't think the world's going to fall apart over this.
No. Like I say, I'm kind of ambivalent about St. George. I don't live there. I don't have a dog in the hunt.
Well, people like our business, we're now going to be in St. George, Louisiana. We'll have to change all the stationery, I guess.
Right? I guess so.
But you take out 86,000 affluent people, and as we know, crime it's mostly an economic issue. Where there is poverty, there is more crime. That's why in the South we have more crime.
Yeah.
It's not because we have more people of any ethnic persuasion. It's because we're undereducated and we're
poor.
Poor. Okay. Well, you take out the area that is the most affluent in Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge is already in the top 10 nationally in murders per capita. Now when you do it per capita.
Top three, isn't it?
Well, in some, every now and then it gets, usually by the end of the year, we settle down to like eighth or ninth. New Orleans is right there too. But I would imagine if you take out 86,000 people who largely are not killing each other, it's going to make Baton Rouge the most murderous, on the record, the most murderous city in America.
Probably so. Yeah, probably.
Which will be great for
zoom past Chicago.
For bringing people to our community, yep. Which we know to be a great community. But now Chicago, by the way, per capita is not number one, not even in the top 10. It just has more murders because it has more people. But St. Louis is the most deadly city in America.
St. Louis is, people don't realize how far down St. Louis has gone. I used to be a big follower of the St. Louis Cardinals, used to listen to them every
night.
Yeah.
You listened to Jack Buck and Harry Carey?
Harry Carey and Joe Garagiola was with
them. Yeah, I remember when I was a little kid in New Orleans. Yeah. I could pick them up on KMOX, and then when I moved to Little Rock, Carey was only with them a few more years before he was allegedly fired for having an affair with a boss's wife.
Right.
That'll do it most every time.
Just about.
But I listened to Jack Buck for years, and my mother said, you know, you heard his voice more than any other voice, more than your father who died when you were eight.
I have a friend.
162 games a year, by the way.
Yeah, 154 back then.
Well.
But 162 now, yeah.
162. You're going way back.
Oh, yeah.
Way back.
Oh, yeah. I at one time, I could name the starting lineups for all 16 major league teams. Now there's 32 major league teams.
Well, if you listen to the Cardinals, who won the world title in 67 and then lost to Denny McClain.
And 64.
And 64, yeah, 1964. They beat the Phillies to win the National League pennant. And then beat the Yankees in 7 games.
Beat the Yankees 4-3.
And then their manager went to manage the Yankees, Johnny Keene. But in 67, catcher was Tim McCarver, first base Orlando Cepeda, second base Julian Javier, shortstop Dal Maxville, third base
Kurt
Mike
Flood.
Shannon. Outfielder was center field Kurt Flood, Lou Brock in left, and Roger Maris in right. Mm-hmm. That was the Cardinals' starting lineup for the year of 1967. But St. Louis is still a great city. And that's just it, is in most American cities, the crime is largely in areas where people are poor and undereducated.
Yeah.
That's the way it works. And in Louisiana, we're now doing this. And presumably the reason for St. George was to enhance the schools.
Yeah.
Did we really enhance the schools by doing this? Or do we take resources away from schools that are not in St. George? That is a concern.
Yep.
So we're going to get Tom Aswell on stuff he's following very closely, including the prospect of a constitutional convention. And also, open records. Is Louisiana going to gut its open records law? Scott Sternberg, who represents the advocate, who's now taking Jack Weiss's place as the foremost First Amendment lawyer in the state, he believes the lawmakers are going to come to their senses on this. But we'll talk about that and more with the intrepid Tom Aswell, still going at age 80, the man from Ruston. 877-217-5757. Yes, he did work, a listener asked. He did work for the Ruston Daily Leader with O.K. Davis, right?
Yes, I did.
All right. Yep. There we go. We're back after this timeout with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening to Talk Louisiana. Today is the final day of April, April 30th, 2024. And Louisiana became a state on this date in 1812. 212 years ago. Where were you that day, Tom, as well?
Well, let's see. I was just, I was very young then.
And speaking of the man from Ruston, not so far away is West Monroe, the town that produced one of the great athletes in the history of Louisiana, Jerry Lane Stovall. He is 83 years old today. And happy birthday to Coach Stovall.
Yeah, he was a good one. I remember watching him play in high school.
He was a good one. And, you know, when he came out of high school, he was not heavily recruited. And Red Swanson was an assistant for LSU. Same guy who got LSU, Y.E. Tittle, and he went to West Monroe. He knew about Stovall. He'd seen him play, liked him, offered him a scholarship. He says, I'm going to Tech. And he said, it took two trips, but Swanson drove to Baton Rouge twice from West Monroe with Stovall in tow. And both times he got stopped for going 100 miles an hour. And both times he talked the state troopers out of giving him a ticket. And he would say, you know, LSU is very special in these parts. Stovall said that's what made him a Tiger. He thought, if I go to LSU, I'll own the state. And he did for a while.
Yeah.
But even he got
nice
fired.
Guy.
Yeah, very good man. Good man. Person. Quality man. I know he listens sometimes. So best to Jerry and Judy Stovall on birthday number 83. 877-217-5757. So Tom Aswell, You were around 50 years ago or so when we had a constitutional convention, and now we're going to have a quickie version.
I covered the constitutional convention for the State Times.
Well, then we elected delegates. Took months, months and months and months, didn't
that's,
it?
That's correct. Yep.
So you're not all that optimistic that we're going to do better by rushing lawmakers to the table with 27 appointees from the governor.
Not at all.
To sift through 77,000 words that are in the current Constitution. You say it's more than 17 times the length of the U.S. Constitution.
That's correct, yeah.
So is this a prospect for disaster, or could this actually work?
It's a prospect for unmitigated disaster, Jim. Unless, as I said yesterday, unless they have already met and have already done this thing, and it's just going to be passed in front of them for them to sign off on. That's the only. But even then, 216 amendments since 1974. Who's to say we're not going to start amending it immediately, especially if it's done a rush job like this? It's just slapped together, and it's going to push through. And if they do that, they're going to be amending it from now on, just like they are the current Constitution.
Well, the governor says it will be a precision matter. That's why it won't take as long as some fear it will, including Cameron Henry, who says we're leaving June 3rd. We got to get it done by June 3rd. Can they do that? And a listener asks a good question. This is Tracy at the Capitol. Can they get voter support?
I don't think so. I don't think it'll pass muster by the voters.
But in fairness, as we know, governors, including a guy that you didn't like very much, Bobby Jindal, when they start cutting, they don't have a lot of room to cut with the current constitutional provisions.
Right, right, right. And I know what Landry's saying about it, but I don't trust him. I don't try to. He's done too many things that he's gone back on his word too many times. He's advocated transparency, and now he's closing the curtain on transparency. So I don't trust him with this Constitution. I'll be honest with you.
Well, what about the bill to basically thwart the public records law? Now, even as you know, even with the current law, it's hard to get the stuff.
It absolutely is. The current law says they have to respond immediately if the record's available. If not, they have to respond immediately to let you know within three working days when it will be available. You make a request to the state police, you get a response that they will try to have the records in 45 days. That's the standard answer, 45 days. If you're on a deadline, that's impossible.
Is that the motive, too?
Absolutely, it's the motive. Of course it is.
You're a cynic these days, Tom.
No, I'm a realist.
I love you.
I'm a realist.
Okay. What about LSU and the Tiger Athletic Foundation? Here we have a public university, but most of the business out there is done privately.
That's correct.
And that's with the current law.
Yeah. That's a horse of a different color, I think, because, I mean, mm-hmm. as you said, it is a private entity, and it's funded privately. That's a whole different ballgame. If I want to give my money to the TAF, then that's my choice.
But it should be a public record.
Theoretically, yes, it should. Yeah.
Okay. Just like contributing to a campaign.
Yep.
And a listener, and we've talked about this, and I'm glad somebody brought this up. This is Hal in Monroe. That deal with Playfly and the Tiger Athletic Foundation, we don't know what was in. Actually, it was Playfly and Caesars, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I wrote about that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote a long story in Tiger Rag about it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I'm glad that Hal in Monroe reads Tiger Rag, but we don't know what.
No, in fact, Bob Mann just had a column that addressed that very thing about how LSU is selling out to corporations, and he mentioned it getting in bed with organized gambling. And
encouraging students to do it.
Yeah, and he had a very fine
column about underage and illegal gamblers if they're gambling
yeah,
under 21.
Right,
yeah.
And I'll predict right here, right now, with this gambling the way it is right now, and advertising on television, we're going to see some serious problems in college athletic.
Well, look at Kayshawn Booty. That was a one-day story, but that guy was betting on LSU games.
Yeah.
How do
yeah.
we know he was not betting against the
Well,
Tigers?
What about Iowa, the player up there that was betting against his team?
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on with Tom Aswell.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Aswell.
Good morning.
Got to set it up a little bit. I was in Manila, and I heard some noise out the window. I looked, they got this guy with a big jackhammer beating up the road. He's got flip-flops and short pants on. Now, I'm wondering, three or four more sessions with Jeff Landry. Would you think we're going to get a little closer to that guy in Manila and then not be able to report it in the paper?
All right. That's Mike, who's a big labor guy.
Yeah.
Mike Day. And,
Oh, that's Michael Day? Hey, yeah, Mike, Michael how Day. You doing, yeah, my man? Yeah. Good friend of mine.
But Landry was elected by the people, and sure, he didn't make some of these things a campaign message, but there's really no surprise about what he's doing, is there?
I think so. I think there is. Edwin Edwards, when he campaigned in 73 for his first term.
71.
One of the planks of his campaign was the Constitutional Convention, and he was very open about it. Landry didn't
Well, Landry
a word
didn't have
it.
To. Edwards had a close race. I mean, very beat Bennett Johnson, 4,422
yeah.
votes.
And if Cato Parish had a bigger turnout.
Yeah, but so then, if it had been a close race, Landry would have had to play his cards, but it wasn't, and the people... They didn't care. They voted him over 15 other options.
Yep.
So, if for people
well,
to say he doesn't
field.
Have a mandate because
look,
a lot of people didn't vote, I disagree.
Against him, though. He didn't have a Bennett Johnson running
Well,
against
but
him.
he had some quality people in yeah. that field. It's funny when you lose, you're a nobody.
Yeah.
But Stephen Wagosbeck, quality guy. Hunter Lundy, quality guy. John Schroeder, quality fellow. They all had money. Sharon Hewitt. And Sean Wilson. They were five strong opponents in that race. So Landry won, and he won going away. So for those who don't like what they're getting, where were you on Election Day when 65% of the people stayed home?
That's correct. What 18% elected?
Of the total voters.
Yeah.
And that doesn't include kids. And there are about a million who are underage. So, yeah there you go.
Yep.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Tom. Please be brief, David.
Good morning. If the new Constitution passes, it may eliminate the state income tax. And if it does, I'd like to see a movement where if you have income, say, of less than $25,000, you get a percentage based on your income of the you get a rebate on the sales tax.
All right. Well, we got to find money somewhere. Now, Foster Campbell was on the show yesterday and said, look, we can find the money through an oil processing tax. And he's right.
Yeah.
Now, Jeff Landry has the mojo right now. He could make that happen.
Is that the quail tax that he voted for years ago?
That he voted against. Foster voted against it. Now he's for it.
Oh,
but
okay.
He was an Edwin Edwards guy, and Edwards,
right.
of course, was on the sidelines trying to stop Dave Treen from having any success. But Treen was right, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And Foster says so now.
Yeah, he does. In fact, he admits he was wrong, too, which is a rarity for a politician.
Foster's very candid.
He is, as he noted yesterday, in a regional or statewide office, he's the last white Democrat standing.
Yeah,
in
he
Louisiana.
Is.
He That's
is.
It.
Yep, and he voted against this Entergy.
As did his cohort, Devontae
that's,
Lewis.
That's correct.
Phil in Jefferson, please be brief. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I'm looking at a Louisiana bill proposes removing lunch break for employed minors. They're talking about child labor laws, and this is basically Republican politics.
All right. I don't like putting a party label on it, but big business is in favor of this.
Yeah, I've already written about that.
Well, is it a bad idea?
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. People deserve a lunch break. I mean, one reader responded to me that they get paid for this. Well, they don't. You work an eight-hour day. You work from 8 to 12, and then you break a break from 12 to 1, and then 1 to 5. That's your 8 hours. You don't get paid for 9 hours.
Okay. Well, Tom Aswell, it's always good to catch up with you. Glad you're still in the game. Keep going. You look hale and hearty. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Thank you.
And he loves LSU. He's got on a jacket, even though occasionally he reports about what's happening at the old war school, and the hierarchy doesn't like it, but we like it.
And I'm still a Louisiana Tech fan. Don't forget that.